Welcome to the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School, so listen, learn, enjoy, and share.
Welcome to this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. 20 years ago, Mary Story's 10-year-old daughter, Rosie May, was murdered by a teenager at a neighbour's Christmas party. 2 months later, Mary and her husband, Graham, set up the Rosie May Foundation in their daughter's memory. The foundation has since developed into an international charity, raising millions of pounds to educate children, empower women, and help families lift themselves out of poverty. Mary is the charity's inspirational CEO. Over the years, she has driven campaigns as wide-ranging as building children's homes for orphans in Sri Lanka, providing clean water for earthquake victims in Nepal, and now empowering women here in Britain to become taxi drivers through the Think Pink campaign. She is an award-winning leader who has built a hugely respected charity on the back of a terrible family tragedy. Mary Story, it is a real honour to have you as a guest on the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast.
My pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
20 years on, how do you reflect on that night when Rosie May was murdered?
Well, it all still seems very surreal, really, Mike, I think. And I think maybe it always will. But if you'd have told me, you know, at any point around that time that, you know, I would be here today.
20 years. It's exactly 20 years.
Yes, yeah.
Does it seem that long?
Yeah. Some ways it does, and then some ways, in many ways, it just seems like a heartbeat, you know? And I think the trauma means that we can travel back to that time like that in a heartbeat. But then, you know, when I think about that actually Rosie May would be 30 this year, then, you know, and I look at her friends who are that age, and that's when it seems like 20 years to me.
12 months after Rosie May's death, you went to Sri Lanka for a holiday to escape the memories of the previous Christmas. Mm-hmm. And that's when the tsunami hit. And you had planted a tree to remember Rosie May, and the tree survived. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the little palm tree we planted on Christmas Day and with a little plaque. And after the tsunami had hit the island, we kind of, you know, just kind of went around, you know, sort of looking at the damage and the devastation and, you know, the docks where the seaplanes land had all been ripped out.
And, of course, you were thankfully on the other side of the island. You survived, although a lot of people died on the side where you planted the tree.
We were on the lagoon side of the island because we were waiting to go out on a dive boat. Had we have gone out on that dive boat, apparently it was like being in a washing machine. You were tumbled around. And because we'd just qualified as paddy divers, that was our final dive. And we were going out onto the outer reef to watch the hammerheads in the Big Blue. So we would be clinging to the outer reef. So there's no doubt that we would have been tumbled off that reef into the Big Blue. So actually, you know,
there but for the grace of God.
Exactly. And you know, that was when we found the palm tree and there was all this devastation around it and literally just debris swirling around it and it stood perfectly untouched. For us, we felt that was a sign that Rosie May had kept us safe.
Right. She kept you safe and it inspired you
to start the charity.
Yeah. I mean, you had started the charity before you went.
We had, because we'd had money. Because obviously, well, thankfully, child murders are rare, but high profile in the media. So we'd had money that had been sent to us actually from all over the world. And they'd sent it, people had sent it in good faith for our family to use, but we kind of didn't feel comfortable with that. So we opened up an account and just put the money into the account. Before we left, we gave half of it to Sheffield Paediatric Intensive Care Unit, where Rosie Mae spent the last 48 hours of her life. And so we had 11,000 left. So when we came back, we watched the death toll rise on the TV, because when you're there, you don't kind of understand what's going on. And we thought, well, maybe this is somewhere, something that we can do with the money. We looked at other, we thought about other things, like maybe a, you know, a bench in our village, or, you know, something kind of like that. But, you know, we kind of felt we identified with people that had lost loved ones in the tsunami.
So you used, you got back after going through the tsunami, and you got back and you decided, right, this is the foundation, we're going to do something with it. And over the next 20 years, you used it as a vehicle to raise millions of pounds for special projects. Before you had those experiences, both at home and in Sri Lanka, did you ever think about taking on such a prominent and a public leadership role?
No. What the charity's done for me personally is it's given me a channel for my grief to turn something tragic into something positive. So I think that's a huge benefit, not only to me, but to, you know, my other family members as well. And it's given me a purpose, a sense of purpose. And I think that's kind of, you know, when you find yourself in the situation that we found ourselves in with bereavement and loss, is you lose your sense of purpose, and you've got to have something that's just kind of worth getting out of bed for, really.
Right. But you had a number of years of success with the foundation to start with. You got involved in a number of projects in Sri Lanka, in Nepal. And it got probably, what, you can tell me, 5, 6, 7, 8 years into it, and you thought, look, I need to take this to another level. So tell us what you did.
Yeah. So, yeah. I had contacted somebody who, he was just retiring, actually, as a CEO of a kind of a medium-sized charity. And he'd been a CEO of a huge charity and then downsized to a medium-sized charity, and now he was retiring. And so I spent some time with him, and, you know, he was, you know, kind of mentoring me in terms of the charity. And the first thing he said to me, the first thing he said to me when he first sat down was, so tell me what's going to happen to your charity, to your life's work, if you, you know, go under a 23 bus tomorrow and you're not able to do your job anymore. And, you know, I said,
that's a
really good question.
Yes, yes.
And he's like, who's going to step into your shoes?
You know, who's going to be the leader?
Yeah, exactly. Who's going to be the leader? But also, who's going to do this for nothing? You know,
because you weren't taking a salary. You were just,
you know, it was completely leading, voluntary. And so it kind of, you know, started from there, really. And, you know, I decided that, you know, I needed to almost professionalise myself. I mean, I'm a nurse, I'm a teacher, my background, but I kind of felt I needed to professionalise myself in that industry, in that space, and be able to walk the walk, talk the talk, so to speak. So I decided to apply for uni. So I came to NTU as a mature student, as one of the very rare mature students at the time.
At that time, yes.
Yeah. I even bought myself a pair of Uggs so that I looked the same. But I absolutely loved, loved, loved every minute of it.
And you were very successful. You're probably too modest to mention this, but you passed with first class honours and then went on to do a master's honours as well.
I was awarded the Dean's Award for High Academic Achievement. And then, I went on to do my MA.
Up the road in Nottingham, yes.
Yes. And
and all the time you were still leading, running, CEO of the charity?
I was, yeah.
Which was growing at a pace?
Which was, yes, that's right, yeah. So
and you were able to take what you were learning and use it to develop the charity?
I was, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think it gave me that confidence as well to be able to do that. And it just opened so many doors for me, to be honest. The kind of the recognition I got from my work, from my studying. I did a semester over at the University of Queensland, and again there I was awarded the Dean's Award for High Academic Achievement. I was awarded the Laureate Post Alumni Award at Uni of Nottingham. So, you know, kind of it gave me the exposure and confidence, I guess, to.
And this is all a great advert for that idea of continuous learnings that for leaders furthering their skills, developing as they go along.
Yeah.
I mean, was that a conscious thing that you'd done? You said you spoke to your mentor at the beginning of it. Did you quite realise where it was going to take you?
It was a conscious decision to come to uni, but no, I mean, I never kind of realised where it would take me.
And on reflection, it's possibly the best thing.
It really was the best thing I ever did. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So one of the things that you have done through the charity, one of the things the Rosie May Foundation has done consistently is to promote female empowerment. Now, that's a big issue today. Mm-hmm. Here we are in 2024. But it wasn't always that way, certainly in the early years of your own organisation. So as a respected female leader yourself, you know, what do you think has changed over that last two decades?
I think when we first started the foundation, we focused more on children, obviously Rosie May's memory, but we always focused more on the girl child, if you want to use that kind of speak. So we always focus more on girls because we felt that they were more disadvantaged than boys in many ways.
Certainly in Sri Lanka and Nepal,
exactly,
and places like that.
Exactly. So that was what we did. And then, of course, that kind of led to then women's empowerment, because obviously we became involved with the mums and the families, and a lot of these mums were single parent mums. And of course, there's not the same kind of security network as there is here. So they were really pretty much on their own, to be honest. So that was kind of where we then felt, you know, we could focus on kind of get to the root cause of the issue, which was always poverty, but get to these women before they got to that desperate situation where they had actually no choice but to give their child to an orphanage because there were no other alternatives. We became kind of involved with women's empowerment then because there's a whole move towards, obviously, children being cared for in the family unit rather than being put into institutionalised care.
And this is where your pink tuk-tuk idea evolved, the taxis.
Yes.
So that was in Sri Lanka. Tell us about that.
So that was, you know, a way of economically empowering women. To be able to earn basically a man's wage in a man's world. We did start off doing kind of all the stereotype kind of gendered, kind of occupations that women do, but they didn't seem to earn enough income for these women that were head of households. The other issue in Sri Lanka specifically was that the UN had also just released findings of research they'd done, whereby over 90% of women had been found to be sexually harassed on public transport at any one time. It was kind of a mission-driven solution.
So there was a big gap in the market.
It had like a double impact.
Double impact,
yeah,
yes.
Exactly. So we started that and, we had to train the women to drive. I mean, you know, absolutely from scratch, it was training them to drive. you know, sort of offering like a package, you know, like a whole kind of startup package with, you know, business development skills, you know, managing, you know, their income, customer service, you know, like that, the whole thing, personal safety, the whole thing. And then, and it's always been a vision of mine to be able to do that here.
Right, and bringing the Pink Tuk Tuks
like
back
the
over
concept,
the
yeah.
concept
yeah.
over to Nottingham.
Yeah,
to, yes,
because right here in the UK, less than 3% of taxi drivers are women, for no good reason, right? And so there's a lot of parallels between the taxi drivers here, the women taxi drivers here, and the women taxi drivers in Sri Lanka. I mean, obviously the major difference is they drive Pink Tuk Tuks. Here they drive hybrid cars, but...
Are they pink as well or not?
They have pink stripes.
They have pink stripes, okay.
And they have our smiley face logo on the wing mirrors. But the parallels are that this is, you know, a job whereby women can work flexible hours and work it around their numerous commitments that women tend to have, and particularly single parent mums.
And it's been operating here in Nottingham for the last year,
last year, and
it's been successful.
We have just signed up our 36th driver.
Right.
Hugely successful, and successful because what the women like is actually the female empowerment part of it. They like to be part of a community of other women drivers. So it becomes, you know, like a self-supporting community that they're now in. And they like to know that actually what they're doing is also helping other women to get, you know.
If you had a double reason for being successful in Sri Lanka, this is treble reason, because you have a women feeling safer, you have women drivers being empowered, but then you're also, this is a commercial arrangement, isn't it? You also have raising money for the charity, for the foundation.
Yeah. It's a commercial venture.
So everybody wins.
Yeah, exactly. So it funds, obviously the funds go straight back into the program. So we can get more women drivers on the road, yeah.
This is an organisation which works across a number of countries, has offices in Britain, and I think there's one in Australia as well. From a leadership point of view, how, on a practical level, how difficult is that? How do you manage that?
I mean, in Sri Lanka, we have a legal entity. So we do manage that ourselves. So we actually employ a team of local people in Sri Lanka. So I manage them. And in Nepal, we work on a different model. So in Nepal, we work on a partnership model. We're not directly managing. We are, you know, working with a partner that does the implementation. So we're more of a funding partner in that model. Obviously over here, right here in Nottingham, then, we've set up a social enterprise to manage that. So we just work on different models which are relevant to, you know, kind of the location that you work.
With you at the top, you hold it all together yourself.
Yeah, pretty much. I have a team. We do employ a team of, a small team.
But over the years, you've raised millions.
We have.
Yeah. And what drives you on?
Rosie May, I guess, you know, I just want her memory to be there for forever, you know, and actually now I kind of think, you know, I have to really stop and think when I'm working with people or supporters or people like, even, you know, people like you, for example, I have to really stop and think actually, do you know what? You never knew Rosie May, but it's kind of like you did. Do you know what I mean? And
yeah.
That for me is a really comforting thing. But actually, when I think about the people who did know Rosie May, obviously that circle is forever decreasing, right? but it doesn't really feel like that. And so I think that is my, you know, that is my drive.
Keeps you going.
What I do. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So as you've already mentioned, or as we have already mentioned, you're a graduate of Nottingham Trent, and you got your master's up the road at Nottingham University. So this is a podcast for the Nottingham Business School. So for all the leaders and would-be leaders there, what one final piece of advice might you give them in their leadership careers, like something that you've learned over the last two decades?
I think just always strive for what you feel you want to achieve. And if you don't know what you want to achieve, then just go with it. You know, I try to not turn down any opportunities, and I push myself out of my comfort zone probably most days. And I think that's a big part of being able to develop and be able to grow, because, you know, it's not an easy thing to do. But I think probably take yourself out of your comfort zone.
So push yourself out of your comfort zone every day. That's good advice. Mm. So Mary Storey, CEO of the Rosie May Foundation, thanks very much for being our guest on this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast.
If you enjoyed this episode, why not check out some of the others that are also available, including those with the Managing Director of Experian UK, José Luis Rossi, gold medal-winning Paralympian Charlotte Henshaw, and two Michelin star chef Sat Baines. This episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast was produced for Nottingham Trent University by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.